Senate Judiciary Committee is called to order. We do have a quorum consisting of myself, Senator McGuire, my Vice Chairman, Senator John Coghill, Senator Mia Costello, and Senator Bill Willikowski. We have two items on the agenda today. Senate Bill 43, which we did not get to last hearing. And so we're going to bring that bill up. It's a bill by Senator Coghill. And I want to start off by saying our deepest gratitude to the fire chiefs that waited online. There are three of them that are also online again today. Chief Mitch Flynn, Chief David Gibbs, and Chief Jill Dolan. And thank you to them. We know that Chief Dolan and Chief Gibbs are just online for questions, but we will have Chief Flynn offer some testimony. But before we do that, we're going to go ahead and have Senator Coghill offer his testimony and Mr. Jordan Chilling offer a little bit, and then we're going to set the bill aside so that we can have the confirmation hearing for the Attorney General today. So without further ado, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill today. So Senate Bill 43 deals with immunity issues with regard to fire departments. And in the interior and in some other places in Alaska, we depend upon volunteer fire departments and a contract with the borough. But it looks like the immunity question between the borough and these has come into question. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to have Jordan Chilling come up, who has really been at the heart of the issue. And he can explain to you how the actual verbiage works. And there is some, I think there was a CS that was going to be offered.
I was going to ask for a motion on that as well, Senator Coghill.
And that would be the H version, right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
I have P.
That was the first bill I had in my packet here.
I've got P.
P? Oh, see? My apologies, it's probably in the back instead of the front.
Okay.
But with that, we do have the P version, and what I'd like to do, Madam Chair, is move that we adopt the P version of the Senate CS for Senate Bill number 43.
Excellent.
And then Mr. Schilling can explain what the differences are.
Perfect. Is there an objection to adopting version P for purposes of discussion?
And Madam Chair, I have the N version. Maybe we're crossing wires a little bit here.
Okay,
let's take a brief at ease. Back on the record, we have version P before us. I asked if there was an objection to the motion to have P before us. There wasn't any. So without further ado, we'll hear the explanation of the changes.
For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Just real briefly, the changes between the version sent to Senate Judiciary and the CS that we're contemplating adopting. There was a concern in some of the House committee meetings on this bill. We do have a House companion that this immunity might somehow apply to a relationship that a contract fire department would have with a private entity. So we just create a little exception here to that immunity on lines 11 through 13 of the bill that just makes it clear that immunity does not apply to that kind of a relationship.
What page?
Page 1, lines 11 through 13. Unless the action, and then it continues, an act or omission of an employee or member of a fire department in the execution of a duty under contract with a private entity.
Okay, got it. Yep. Madam Chair, if Mr. Schilling could at least then now introduce the concept and the actual language of this bill, I think it would be good to put that in context.
Okay. Mr. Schilling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. This bill, Senate Bill 43, it addresses a problem that the Fairbanks North Star Borough brought to our attention during the interim relating to contract fire departments. So we immediately began working with the borough and the municipality of Anchorage to craft legislation that would address the issue. The issue being Alaska has a statute that provides immunities to the employees of fire departments and also provides some immunities to the departments themselves. And governments create immunities for itself all the time. It's very common but especially in public safety areas. And so most, if not all, states give immunities to fire departments and their staff. And because it's unpredictable work, there's kind of an element of the unknown. You're moving heavy equipment down the street. And governments have an obligation or a duty to provide that service to their citizens, and they do it all in good faith. So a little history on our fire immunity statute. We established it in 1975, and today that statute is numbered 0965070, and that's what this bill affects. And it was established at the request of the Juneau Volunteer Fire Department back then, and they patterned it after a law from the state of Delaware. I was able to do a little bit of research with the help of our intern to find this all out. And so prior to creating that statute, a firefighter or a city could be held liable for damages. I tried to find some minutes from those meetings. 1975 was actually the first year that they required that the meetings be recorded, so we don't really know the intent of the sponsor and whether he intended to have it cover contract departments. I'm not even clear if contract departments existed back in the 70s. But anyway, they do now. So we've identified 7 fire departments in the state that this immunity does not apply to. Five are in Fairbanks, and they contract with the borough there. And then 2 are down in the Anchorage area, Chugiak and Girdwood. And both of those fire departments contract with the municipality of Anchorage. So because those municipalities utilize contract departments and the statute doesn't cover them, Fairbanks and Anchorage are exposed to some liability that other municipalities aren't exposed to. And that's why in the members' packets you'll see that the municipality of Anchorage is supportive of this, the city of Fairbanks is supportive of this. But it's also the firefighters themselves that are exposed to that, and ultimately the taxpayers, and that's kind of the point of this. So we just feel strongly that these protections shouldn't just be reserved to fire departments operated by municipalities, and they should be extended. And that's the bill, Madam Chair.
Very straightforward. Well, thank you. That's an exciting research project for your intern as well. So thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I'm just trying to understand. It's so Section 1, you're repealing and reenacting, and what's the change you're making there specifically?
And there's a handful of changes.
Well, I guess if I could just rephrase.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
What are you trying to do with the rechange, I guess I should ask?
Yeah, so through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the current statute as it's written just appears to only cover municipally operated fire departments. We need to ensure that it includes departments that are, and I can point this out to you, page 2, lines 2 and 3. This is where we're defining what fire department means for the purposes of this statute. Registered with the state fire marshal and provides services under contract or agreement with a municipality. The current statute doesn't provide for that. Okay.
And the thing that confused me was I'm looking at 096570C right now, and this appears to be have changed it. I don't want to say substantially, but it looks like a lot more words are added to it.
Sure.
And you're saying there the changes in on page 1 are just some legislative cleanup, some legal cleanup?
Yep. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it's true that we didn't use brackets and underlines. That was a drafting decision. Apparently in the drafting manual it says that if you're going to make extensive changes, it's easier to just repeal and reenact. But yes, really the changes from the current statute is to cover contract fire departments, and also we've created an exception to the immunity. An original version of this bill provided really a total immunity, and there was some uneasiness about that, so we created an exception to that total immunity for willful acts of misconduct, or rather intentional misconduct or gross negligence. We took that language directly from the 911 system immunity statutes. We felt that it would be appropriate.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Senator, that was something that I felt very strongly about because I didn't want them to be exempt from honest to goodness, bad behavior. So,
okay.
And those are the standards that I thought were reasonable. And that's not that is not unusual in these types of circumstances.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if I may, Senator Wilkowski, there is one additional change that I wanted to point out before we continue, and that is that 070 subsection C and D provide immunity to fire departments. C is primarily for the staff of the department, and then in D, you'll find that there's some immunities provided to the department themselves. In C, one of the major changes is we've also expanded that immunity for the department itself. So those would be the three things I would say are significantly different from the current statute.
And then if I
Yes, Senator McCloskey. And what I want to do, just because we have Craig Richards is here and I want to spend the time on his hearing, is I'd like us for the next hearing is to bring it forward if we can highlight the substantial changes. There's only one copy of the statutes in here. I just sent Amy a note. We need to get two of them. But let's get a copy of the original 965070C so we can see where the major changes are while we're making policy changes. And then let's drill down on it because we do have Craig Richards here. And if that's okay, Senator Wilkowski, because it is going to take some time. I'm seeing if we can just hold this discussion at bay. I do want to ask Chief Flynn if he will be available to come back at the next hearing or if time is of the essence and Chief needs to testify now.
It depends on when the next meeting would be scheduled, but I'm available now, and my comments are short if you want to hear it.
Okay, go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Okay, for the record, my name is Mitch Flynn, Fire Chief of the Speech Volunteer Fire Department. I work for a nonprofit organization here in Fairbanks, and we provide both fire and EMS services under contract to the Fairbanks North Star Bill. And this past year, the bill brought to our attention the lack of need to protection that we may have as a contractor, and which could also make us end with lawsuits, but also the taxpayer that we serve could be liable for huge payouts that could happen in a lawsuit that's unforeseen at this time. We certainly support this legislation and everything that Jordan has spoke to so far. And we're asking for that unity protection so we can better protect the citizens that we serve. And thank you for your time. I'll answer any questions.
Okay, questions for the chief? Okay, thank you so much, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, we'll set Senate Bill 43 aside and bring that back up. And we'll bring it back up with a better side-by-side of what the changes are, the substantive. And so, Craig Richards, if you'd come forward and put yourself on the record, welcome to Senate Judiciary today.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Craig Richards, Attorney General, for the record. Personal address, 1435 N Street, Anchorage, Alaska.
So, Craig, anything you want to tell us in opening remarks? You've already had one hearing, and I assume you have a personal style. We'll let you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself if you'd like. That I found that's kind of a better way to warm up and let us know who you are and why you're interested in accepting the governor's phone call to assume this big task.
Thank you, Senator. And to the other senators through the chair that heard the background here in the last few days, I'll try to go through a little faster so you don't hear too much about my schooling and where I grew up. I did grow up in Fairbanks, Alaska. My family moved there when I was two. They're originally from Georgia. I had an aunt that moved up to Fairbanks in the 50s on my mother's side. And over a period of about 20 to 30 years, a bunch of the Georgia clan and a little bit from Texas did move up to Fairbanks and a little bit into Anchorage. So that's sort of how my family migrated, just followed this very wonderful woman. My father had the opportunity in 1977 in September to transfer up with federal probation. So we took it, which is ultimately what brought me up and my mother and father. My father was a state trooper and a federal probation officer his entire career in law enforcement in Alaska. My mother worked at Consolidated Freightways in Fairbanks and managed the Smart Builder Supply Office in Fairbanks, and for the last 20 years ran All Seasons Inn, which is a bed and breakfast in Fairbanks downtown, which she recently just sold in the last couple of months, so is now enjoying for the first time in her life retirement, so that's great for the family. I attended Wood River and Pearl Creek Elementary Schools, Ryan Middle School, and graduated from West Valley High School in 1993. After graduating from West Valley High School, I attended the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I studied finance. I had originally wanted to study Civil War history, but my dad told me I had to choose again and get something that was a little more practical. So I didn't quite minor in history, but I was pretty close. And I did, in fact, study finance. I knew at a young age that I wanted to return to Alaska, so I didn't even take a break after undergrad, and where most of my peers went off and either went to Wall Street or went to you know, some of the broker houses elsewhere, several in San Francisco. I just went straight into law school and went to Washington and Lee Law School, which is also in Virginia. It's in Western Virginia. Its claim to fame is it's where General Lee went after the war until his death. After at Washington and Lee, again, I knew I was going to come back to Alaska. So I made law school a fun experience because I knew where I was headed, whereas a lot of my peers did not. My first job out of law school was to clerk for Ralph Beislein, who was on the Superior Court at the time in Fairbanks. I clerked for Ralph Beislein. And then afterwards, putted around for a few months trying to figure out what I was going to do and where I was going to work, and ultimately ended up getting a job working for Wolforth, Vassar, Johnson & Breck, a law firm founded by Eric Wolforth when he came up to do all of the refinancings after the earthquake. The firm focused, in my practice with the firm, focused primarily on public finance, which is municipal bonding and helping local governments raise money in the capital markets through the issuance of bonds. I did that. The actual project, humorously enough, that I was hired to work on, and the reason that they added a person was because there was a project that needed to be researched on whether or not the gas pipeline could be built with tax-exempt bonds. Yeah. So I was actually hired and paid by Dan Fowsky and Pat Gamble through the HFC and Alaska Railroad Corporation. And that, even though that's been well over a dozen years ago at this point, it's still the same players looking at the same issues, that's for sure. Wow. So I did public finance for a couple years until I decided to leave that job. Right after I left, I got a call from a gentleman by the name of Bill Walker, who was working on refinancing of the Valdez Marine Terminal. I had worked the deal on the other side. And so when I basically was a free agent, he hired me to come on and help him do some of those financings. He was representing Valdez and the oil company. So I did that. It was supposed to be a couple-month job, and I ended up turning it into about a dozen-year job. Once I got into the practice with what is now Governor Walker, it was a very fun practice. Very sophisticated issues, primarily involving municipal law, oil and gas tax matters, gas pipeline development, and then I continued over the years to do varying levels of public finance work. I've always enjoyed public finance and municipal bond work, and certainly tried to continue the business and do the work when I can. During my time at Walker and Levesque, and later what became Walker and Richards, I did take off some time to go to Duke University in Durham, where I received my MBA. At that time, I'd been doing a substantial amount of oil and gas work, so I focused my MBA studies to the extent you can. It's a general course of study, but you can certainly focus it on oil and gas quantitative modeling and oil and gas finance. So that's an area that I found very helpful, actually, in my legal practice. As to me personally, I do live in Anchorage. I have my wife, Allison Richards. We were married several years ago. She teaches at West High School in Anchorage. She teaches English as a second language primarily, and then some standard English courses as well. And she's been doing that for about 10 years. I have one son who's 2, Cameron Richards. To address your question, Senator, about why I wanted this job and took the call, I had planned to do that anyway. So it wasn't actually a call. The governor, what is now the governor, about a week before the election maybe, invited me into his office and asked if he did in fact win the election, whether or not I would be interested in the position. And it did take me by surprise. I told the committee last time that I thought my path was pretty well defined. I thought if the governor won, that he was going to leave our law practice and I was going to get the law practice and do that. And that if he lost, he was going to retire and I was going to get the law practice and do that. So I thought I was pretty much on a course of continuing what had been my practice for over 10 years. So I took some time to think about it and had some discussions with my wife and with the governor, and ultimately decided that it was a big change. It was an unexpected change, but it was an opportunity for public service that's really once in a lifetime. So notwithstanding what are, you know, the apparent costs of giving up your business effectively and the time away from your family, I just decided that what a great opportunity to serve Alaskans.
Wonderful. Fantastic. So I will open it up to members for questions. I guess I would say, as you sit back and look at the challenges that you face, and you've got so many aspects, the civil division, the criminal division, the oil and gas aspects, you know, for you, what do you feel are your biggest challenges as you look at your departments? And maybe there are multiple parts of it that you want to tackle, and maybe you want to step back and say, what do you feel they were going into it, and what do you feel they are today, having had time to meet with your individual civil and criminal department heads? And that's the first part. And the second is, how can we support you in the legislature?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Well, I would say that, first of all, any incoming attorney general is blessed in the form of having a Department of Law that is very well functioning, very talented people, long-serving people. The deputies have all been there a long time. The senior attorneys have, for the most part, been there a long time. And it's a very competent organization. I would say that the challenge that is the biggest right now for me and for the department as a whole is dealing with budget reductions. Yeah. The governor set the goal at an 8% reduction from the Governor Parnell's FY16 work in progress budget, which already had $1 million of embedded reductions from the fiscal year 15 budget. So that amounted to about an additional $8 million in budget reductions. And in addition to that, the governor has made it clear that, barring a change, it's his expectations that the Department of Law's plan for budget reductions in the amount of 25% over the next several years. So certainly the 8% reduction that we've experienced this year, we think we can manage, and we can do it without majorly impacting the services we provide on the criminal side and child welfare or on the civil side. But the next hurdle and the next series of challenges, which we begin to need to plan for, is reshaping the Department of Law to provide as high a level legal services as possible and protect Alaskans as much as possible while recognizing the potential budget realities. Yeah. So it's a multi-year process, and it's one that we are fortunate that we have the savings in the bank to allow sort of working towards that. But I would say that that's my biggest challenge, and working with the criminal division, the civil division to meet them has been, I would say, it's occupied a lot more time than I would have thought. I didn't think I would come into the Attorney General's position and spend my time as a budget manager, but, you know, we all arise to the circumstances of the time.
Right. You're going to be competing against the private sector, particularly when you think about oil and gas, mm-hmm. in those areas where you're looking for that expertise. Certainly that's going to be a big issue. Well, I'm going to turn it, I've got more questions, but I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to members. Senator Costello.
Oh, I defer to the vice chair.
Okay. Senator Gonko.
Well, first of all, I had an opportunity to ask him a lot of questions in the resource committee, and I tried to keep those just on resource issues, but they deal with a lot of our federal issues, and so I'll get to those in a minute, but I appreciate the fact that you get into an organization that has already got expertise in a lot of areas, so I think you do have a good group. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, I know you haven't had a lot of criminal experience, so you are going to be learning at a very high rate of speed. So are you going to keep your criminal group intact? Do you see things coming? I mean, obviously, with maybe budget issues, that's going to be tougher.
Right.
But you probably have a much better working relationship looking down the civil side than you do down the criminal side. So first impressions is what I was looking for, since that is a new world to you in many ways. But new eyes sometimes really tell us a lot.
So, Senator Coghill, through the chair, certainly a fair observation that I don't have a lot of criminal experience. I think other than defending one idiot high school buddy right after I was barred, the number of times I've handled criminal cases is once. So that's true. But I'm certainly not unique in that. I think it's fair to say that many of the past attorney generals have not had a deep criminal background going in. And I'm sure, like them, I'm just really digging in and starting to learn. I think now is a time where it's particularly important that I engage the criminal division. It's important on the budgetary side, and it's also important just because of the organization, Senator, that you're involved with, and a lot of the Rethinking Justice initiatives that are occurring. So in terms of dramatic change in the department, I don't see dramatic change except for the fact that the criminal division is going to be impacted by budget reductions. And that does mean in this year alone, a staff reduction, PCN's reductions of about 10 people. So you can expect about a little over half of those probably to be attorneys. So luckily we're in a position where a lot of our reductions, both in the civil and criminal division, can be managed through turnover. The department has about a 10% turnover, which does give you some flexibility to shrink basically through attrition and retirement.
But nonetheless, it is going to require some resizing of the criminal division, and we're certainly looking at how to do that best, keeping in mind the priority of providing equal justice to all Alaskans and not just shrinking out of rural Alaska and into the community, because that's the cheapest way to do it, but it's not necessarily the best way to do it.
And Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, and you're right, all of us on this committee have been working on the anything we can do to change the growth of the prison population and still give people opportunities to turn into a more productive life and keeping the public as safe as we possibly can. So I appreciate that observation, because that deals with both civil and criminal in many ways. Family law is primarily civil law, but because of the nature of the families, quite often they're in criminal cases too, and they get blended together. Protecting families is something that I've taken a particular notice to in the civil law. Protecting families and children. Sometimes as a state we've been tough on families because we have rules to protect children. We had to work hard at trying to keep families together as best we can until there's absolutely no way you can do it. So that's going to be a part of civil law that that we watch. In the civil and criminal law, we have, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm probably one of the least credentialed persons on the committee, but what I have seen as just an observer is that the criminal law issues and the civil law issues blend together. And in the civil law, we have allowed the government to take children for their safety, and that circumvents due process in many ways, because we have said getting children is so important. But we've tried to build in safeguards, and the government is the one that has the authority. And have you had any experience with the family law issues at all?
Senator Cockell, through the chair, I mean, my limited over the years, but I mean, I have certainly had experience coming into the office and learning the role and dealing with some of the issues. So, I mean, I don't have a strong background in it, but I'm not unfamiliar with it either.
It's probably one of the areas, Madam Chair, that just kicks the feet up from under us, because it deals with all of the social ills that we deal with, drug abuse, spousal abuse, sexual assault, everything that we deal with that is really kicking the feet up from Alaska end up in that particular arena. And Madam Chair, I'd like to bring up one other topic with regard to this, because in that arena, it ends up we are forced and want to work with tribal governments as best we can, or tribal units. And it's a little bit of a legal no man's land, and I think you're going to be called upon to make some headway in that area. In child protection issues, we have the Indian Child Welfare Act, and we have now we have tribal courts that are really searching for the right authority. And this is something that it's going to grow. So we've got to figure out how to take our Constitution, which says that governments are supposed to be either boroughs or cities. That's what's recognized in Alaska. And yet we have these tribal groups that can really bring some really wonderful things, including restorative justice, talk in circles, mm-hmm. and healing in communities. We have to blend those together. And have you given much thought to it, or how do you think we should proceed? Or if not, I would certainly give you some encouragement that is coming your way.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, believe me, this is an issue I had to dive in head first on. I mean, there's no getting around it, just because there's a number of pending cases that are rolling forward, but also because it's an issue of such importance to not only the tribal communities, but to law enforcement. So with the tribal issues, you kind of need to take them one by one, because it is such a morass of different bodies of law that control these different issues. But I know, for instance, on the ICWA issues that OCS takes, placement of Indian children with Indian families and in the rural communities is a very top priority. And one of the things that OCS is starting, with the help of the Department of Law, is a process to work with the local tribes and to work with some of the rural constituencies to basically figure out how to better work with local communities to make the hurdles associated with rural placement easier. So that's one thing that's been a direct initiative that's come out of my department, working with Commissioner Davidson in the last month. We've also continued the work that General Garrity started, which is excellent work on the civil diversion agreements, which will provide to some of the tribal communities that choose to enter into them the ability to have cases diverted from the state criminal justice system to the tribal justice system, effectively, for some Class B misdemeanors and some other, you know, cases for first-time offenders and nonviolent offenders, to allow justice to be provided at a local level to the maximum extent possible. And certainly, certainly we've been working on that. And, wow, there's a whole bunch of issues, and we're taking them on one at a time, because I agree, Senator, that we have to balance the interests of the state with the interests of the tribes and recognize the very real value the tribes provide in providing local justice, not only in terms of justice that best suits local communities, but also accessing the federal funds that are potentially available to tribes that can maybe bring in some law enforcement presence and some local presence that the state basically can't afford to provide in some of these communities.
Madam Chair, I know that the Supreme Court, in their working group, has worked hard on trying to figure out ways to work with the communities, and us in the legislature, we've struggled with it in a variety of different ways. One of them is we want structurally to line up with our U.S. and state constitution as much as we can. And then the other thing is, and this is where you come in, the protection of the individual citizen, where they don't get caught in a system that they have no appeal out of.
Right.
So it's a due process question. In a tribal circle, generally, instead of valuing the individual right, values a tribal right, whereas we in our Constitution value the individual right and have all the senses of appeal. And those somehow have to be able to blend up together. And it's been a structural problem that I've really struggled with, because I see the value they bring, mm-hmm. but I don't want it to. I don't want us to create something that is going to be in court forever and ever and ever. And I think Alaska has some wonderful and unique opportunities. And I hope that as you work forward on this, certainly the Constitution is your guideline. But there are ways I think we can reach out. And I just want you to know that we in the legislature have seen the conundrum more than the answers, and as you move forward, we're certainly interested, because you have a big play in it. And I would encourage you to talk to the Supreme Court on it as well.
Thank you, Senator Coghill, through the chair. And I believe more than anyone as Attorney General that the state constitution is my guiding document.
Yeah.
But like you said, I also believe there's a whole lot we can do to work with tribes to make better justice in rural Alaska.
Well, and I think this administration, it's the strongest signal I've seen of any administration in the hiring of Val Davidson, in the hiring of Jared Godfrey as a rural advisor. I think we'll probably see more work in the next 4 years than we have in any other administration. So I look forward to seeing how all of you come forward on this. I want to talk just for a minute about manpower and women power that you're going to put toward relationships with the federal government. And for a minute, I want to talk about the Arctic and EPA. We just talked about budget cuts, so that's unfortunate. But have you looked into EPA's proposed expansion of critical habitat areas at all?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, I have. And in fact, we've just recently joined the lawsuit challenging the critical habitat designation of the ring seal.
Excellent.
So, as with a lot of things, I get to get up to speed as the issues are coming across my desk. So on this one, I'm good to go.
Great. That's fantastic. And that one of the things in co-chairing the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission, another hat that I wear, we flagged a couple areas that I just want to flag for you. We believe that the federal government will try to use the Endangered Species Act in critical habitat areas, and the EPA, they'll use this as a method of blocking development in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Seas with very decisive acts. We also think that when you see what they've come out with in the State Department for the chairmanship of the United States government in the next 2 years, they've come out with climate change and marine stewardship as their top two goals. As you know, the state of Alaska has come out with economic development for the people of the North. They have that as their number three goal, and it's barely mentioned. As a part of the marine stewardship, they've introduced the idea of mapping new marine protected areas. And part of the guide to do that is going to be looking at these new critical habitat areas, that will be guided by protected species. So I'm just flagging it for you. It sounds like you're already flagging it yourself. And I think having the Department of Law bring in some experts in this area and really develop a specific expertise is going to be critically important to us. So maybe just a few more words on it. And just part of this whole federal overreach issue that as we move into the next, I guess I'd say 50 to 100 years of Alaska's history, if we can't develop our natural resources and fill up on our Trans-Alaska pipeline and develop our resources, we don't have anything. We're hamstrung for the future. So when I look at the Department of Law, I see you as that that CEO of a department that is protecting the legal rights for our future. So just a little bit about that.
Madam Chairwoman, I agree with everything you've said, and I'm very grateful to my predecessors who have built internally within the Department of Law an excellent ESA group, basically. And in fact, one of the things that our budget included this year was a $300,000 reduction in outside counsel costs for ESA cases. It's not because we're taking our ESA cases less seriously, it's because we've developed such a good internal group that we're not needing to rely on outside counsel as much. The critical habitat designations that we see in some of the marine mammals, just take the ringed seal for instance, is 350,000 square miles. It is the entire north coast of Alaska and virtually the entire western coast of Alaska, running all the way down to the beginning of the Aleutians Island, all the way to the end of Alaska territorial waters. These designations, and this is for a species that is not currently threatened, based on pseudoscience that says global warming may result in a loss of ice, which may result in the future, in a 100-year study horizon, a threatened population. So the state of Alaska has had very good success challenging what are unscientific critical habitat designations in the form of the bearded seal, as well as in the form of the polar bear, where, as you know, everything north of the Brooks Range was essentially designated unreasonably as critical habitat. So certainly it's my intent to continue those challenges and force the EPA to return to science-based decision-making, not only on listings, but in critical habitat designations.
Excellent. Thank you. Senator Costello?
Thank you. And I hope you noticed, or maybe you didn't, that essentially the Judiciary Committee is a part and parcel of the Resources Committee.
Yes.
So it's nice to see you in another committee's welcome. And actually, some of my questions dovetail with Senator McGuire, so I'm wondering if she's looking at my page here. But I was curious about what you see as the biggest challenge facing the Department of Law. And so you had mentioned the budget. What then is next? What do you see as the next largest challenge?
So the next largest, Senator Costello through the chair, the next largest challenge is linked to the budget, but it's also a little different. And that is, I think, this global idea of re-envisioning justice in Alaska, particularly up through sentencing, as I see it. The Senator Coghill mentioned about sort of some of the high prison populations in Alaska, and I just think about the fact that 40% of our prison population right now is pre-sentencing.
Yes.
Well, that's a stunning figure.
It is.
So right now there is a collective effort that this body began and had certainly started in other capacities before to look at what we can do to make justice smarter in the state of Alaska. And that's something that I'm committed to, not only working with the group set up by the legislature, but also internally within the executive branch, the executive authority, to see what we can do to administer justice cheaper and more efficiently, but without affecting the quality of justice for Alaskans. And it's a big job, and it's going to require working across all stakeholders, public defender, OPA, in the department administration, with the court system. It's going to require working with corrections, and it's going to require working with public safety, and we're going to have to develop a plan, and we're going to have to spend a couple years working towards a more efficient system. And it's partly budget driven, but it's also just quality justice driven.
Yeah, that's good to hear. And I know some states like Texas have done a great job. Oftentimes those kinds of moves to smart justice require an upfront investment, and I'm curious, do you think the administration is willing to make that kind of investment to see the long-term improvements that we hope for in that kind of a move?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I think so, just because I've had conversations with virtually all the heads of the administration and even with the governor's office and the chief of staff. I mean, we're not ready to do it because there's no plan, But as we begin to develop one, I think that there's going to be support for it. If it's money, you know the support's going to have to come through the legislature, the appropriation process, but it'll be up to us to sell you on the intelligence of the ideas.
Do you think Alaska's juvenile justice system is working?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I don't have a strong background in criminal justice, so I'm not going to come out strongly either way. I will say that the criminal justice system is taken very seriously within the Department of Law, and I do know that a lot of resources by the state are put into it. I'm not aware of what I would call any fundamental failures, but I do know that there are issues that people raise that are out there, and we're certainly going to look at them.
Sure, that's fair. And I know you've been asked questions sort of related to this before, but how do you characterize your role as Attorney General? Is it the people's attorney, the governor's attorney? Can you share your philosophy with the committee on that?
Senator Costello, through the chair, yes is the answer, right? As the Attorney General of the state of Alaska, the legislature has, it's not a constitutionally defined position, but it is one that every other state has, so it would certainly be a different approach not to have an Attorney General. And this legislature has characterized the role of the Attorney General as to be consistent with that of an Attorney General at common law, which has a very specific meaning. And, well, meanings, and in specific I mean as vague as the law can be about these things. But as the Attorney General, I do represent the heads of all of the departments and agencies of the state of Alaska within the executive branch, or almost all, there are a few exceptions, as well as the governor's office. But part of your function is also to be the people's attorney, which means that ultimately your final representation is to the public interest and to the interest of the people of Alaska. So yes, you do represent governmental agencies, but at the end of the day, you're the people's attorneys.
And are you satisfied with the conviction rate of the state of Alaska district attorneys?
Senator Costello, through the chair, you always hope you can do better. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, yes, but there are a few things we're looking at. The conviction rates in the state of Alaska, as I understand them, for misdemeanors and felonies is about at 70%. You can look at these statistics and slice them 9 different ways, and I know the public defenders have presented me statistics that are a little different. But you need to find that balance between making sure that you're trying the hard cases, but you're not being irrational about trying every case and not having efficient justice. So I would say the one area that we are looking at is the Department of Law. My predecessor put in place a policy that the state would no longer plea on sentencing in a lot of instances. And there has been some complaint by the judiciary and the public defenders and even some legislators that that is resulting in more trials and resulting in lower conviction rates. So that is one of the things that we're going to look at over the next few months and try to figure out what makes sense.
Do you expect any more changes to the regional district attorneys, and do you see those decisions as political or, policy-driven?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I see some changes for sure. Just it's a function of two things, retirements and budget reductions. I don't see, any other political changes to the extent I assume you're referring to the Bethel DA situation. Nothing like that. I do see that as we reduce the 10 or so people in the criminal division, that there will be some reductions in the rural areas. We're trying very hard to manage those proportionally through urban and rural. But, there's going to be some positions where, somebody gets moved from a regional office to Anchorage. And obviously, we now have an open DA spot in Fairbanks, so that's going to be managed. The Anchorage DA is going to retire pretty soon, so that's going to result in some change in the office. So those are the kind of things we're dealing with.
And in resources, I had asked about, the fact that in many states the AG is elected, and in this state we don't elect the AG, and so therefore you don't have to file an APOC statement. But I just for the record wanted to ask if you received any, from the sale of the governor's firm, did you receive any proceeds from that, or did you have an ownership interest in that firm?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I actually do have to file an APOC report, okay. And all of that is disclosed on the form, although I will tell you the way it's disclosed is so obscure that you couldn't tell anything by it. The answer is that when the firm was sold, I did receive approximately one-third of the proceeds.
We all had to go through that filing recently, so just...
I think I did it on Friday.
And then in resources, I had alluded to some comments you had made, and I mentioned that they were derogatory, and I thought I would just give you an opportunity to just, for me to ask a question just straightforward with what I had read, and then for you to have the opportunity to respond. So with that, you had mentioned that in an August 13th Valdez Star, you were talking about the state's current oil tax system, and a previous governor had referred to it as crony capitalism, and you, in your piece, said you agreed with that characterization. And I just wanted to know, do you still stand by that characterization of Senate Bill 21?
I'll stand by my characterization of what I said in the article. I don't remember the exact words, but I do recall Governor Palin's words. I think the sentiment I was expressing in that was that I didn't feel that SB 21 struck the right balance between what was good for the independents and what was good for the existing legacy producers in the North Slope field. And I still share those concerns.
Thank you. How would you characterize the Point Thompson settlement?
The Point Thompson settlement, so I represented Governor Walker in his challenge of that suit. The characterization of the suit made by me as Mr. Walker's attorney was that it had some serious legal problems, primarily in the way that it's been a while. The gravamen thrust of Mr. Walker's suit was that the Point Thompson settlement agreement went around the DNR regulatory process and adopted a contractual one. So rather than having unit decisions being managed through 11 AC 83303A, you essentially had an alternative contractual structure put in place to sort of guide management of the field. That was the fundamental gravamen.
Okay. The governor, in a September 14th piece, said it was the worst, dirtiest backroom deal in state history. And do you agree with that?
I don't know about the worst, dirtiest backroom deal in state history. I will say that it was a deal done in secret. It was a deal that was done, certainly what I asserted as Governor Walker's attorney, a manner inconsistent with Alaska law.
And then just one final question. Earlier this session, you had to relinquish your authority to participate in decisions regarding the Point Thompson settlement litigation. I was just curious if there are other issues that you foresee that you'll have to recuse yourself from, and then who then will become the lead?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I'm not aware of, other than the few items that were in the initial delegations of authority that occurred around Christmas time, if I recall, there won't be any other issues that I'm aware of, because, of course, any pre-existing issues I had would have had to have been delegated at the time.
And I actually have one final one.
Absolutely.
In terms of with your relationship with the third floor, and when the governor makes announcements about the gas line, are you an advisor to those comments or that direction that he's now taking?
Senator Costello, through the chair, about 30% of the time, just picking a number, I would say. In the last few months, virtually not at all. It's interesting how quickly you get siloed into your agency.
Well, your office is across the street, correct?
And it's, so it's you a have million to actually, miles away.
By the time you get there, right. It might be over.
Right, right.
Okay.
I want to tag on that really quickly, just because that, as you and I spoke about in my office, the only thing I thought that was out there, I said eminently qualified, probably one of the best qualified attorney generals will have, young, exuberant, I think you're going to be a great attorney general. I said to you in my office, I thought the only challenge you'll have is just that you practice law with the governor, and that's unusual. We haven't had that before. And that the both of you were coming directly out of practice into public service. And also that's potentially to our gain as Alaskans. You just stated to Senator Costello that you didn't anticipate that there would be any future conflicts of interest. So just walk us through, so that we have it on the record, what will happen there was an article that appeared in the fall regarding Point Thompson and some other conflicts, and it was stated that to the extent that there was a conflict, that you would go through the lieutenant governor. And so, but then we talked in our office about the fact that there might be another step, that you might go through counsel within the Department of Law. So can you just tell us definitively if there's a flag that's raised about a former client, mm-hmm. What is the process by which you'll go through handling that so that we know what that is?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, why don't I walk you through the process I have gone through, and then if I was to do it again, how I would do it.
Okay.
So it would be a little different because of the difference of being outside and not being inside.
Excellent.
So when the governor ultimately did win the election, or I should say a couple weeks before it became clear if he was going to win the election, and he had at this point asked me if I would be the attorney general, we both knew that there was the potential issue of conflicts just by the nature of the fact that we had both litigated against the state of Alaska. And in my situation, many attorney generals have been in the same situation.
Yep.
So what I did is I immediately hired outside legal counsel to give me advice on how to handle it. Okay. A gentleman by the name of John Cedor in Anchorage. He gave me a letter suggesting what the potential conflicts were. He worked with Steve Van Gore at the bar.
Great.
On that letter.
Yep.
I then, before I came into office, called the ethics attorneys, the Department of Law, independently got them to look at my ethical situation, including a fact pattern rundown of all my cases. The advice that the ethics attorney at the Department of Law gave were virtually identical to what John Cedor's were.
Great.
The only difference was is that the Department of Law attorneys added the nuance of who should be my ethical advisor, because normally the ethical advisor of the attorney general is the governor. So in this circumstance, he pointed out that given the relationship, it should probably be somebody else and recommended it to be the lieutenant governor.
Okay.
So at the ethics attorney's advice, I put out a delegation of my authority to, I believe, Martin Schultz in all instances, who is the section head of oil, gas, and mining, to essentially handle those cases where they thought that it was appropriate for me to do that.
Okay.
In the future, if I were to believe I had future conflicts, obviously I wouldn't hire an outside attorney, but instead what I would do is I would raise it to the ethics attorney within the Department of Law. They would then take the issue to Byron Malott, who decides any potential ethical conflicts for me as my ethics advisor. And just as belt and suspenders, the lieutenant governor has asked and received permission to hire outside counsel for any potential conflict issues related to myself or the governor. So as the attorney general, I had to approve that, but I did not pick who the lawyer was, or in fact, I couldn't even tell you who it was sitting here today. But the governor does have independent legal, the lieutenant governor does have independent legal counsel to provide him advice on potential conflicts that I have.
Excellent. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Attorney General Richards, I think you're going to make a great Attorney General, and I want to commend you. I had recently a piece of legislation that I was working on, and I called the Attorney General's office at the request of the committee chair that's going to hear the bill, and asked them if the committee chair had asked if I could have the AG's office look at it, and we called over, and you yourself came over, and I appreciate your hands-on approach on some of these. It was an important privacy issue. I want to talk about the issue of conflicts because it's come up a few times, and how does your handling of conflicts compare with legislators' handling of conflicts? And I ask that because in the legislature, we have people working for industries or companies that vote on issues and write bills that directly affect their industries. You, under the rules of professional conduct, can you explain? I mean, that's clearly prohibited, and could you explain the difference? I mean, people are concerned about your conflicts. You couldn't ethically even do something like that. Is that fair to say?
Well, Senator Wilkowski, I think there's one thing that I have in common with the people of this body, which is I'm going to follow the rules.
Yeah.
So I'm not as familiar with your rules as I am, for instance, I'm very familiar with the Open Meetings Act conflict provisions for municipal bodies. I've dealt with that for years. That's a different set of rules than what this legislative body has in terms of conflicts, and that's a different set of rules than what the rules of professional conduct for attorneys puts forward, and it's a little bit different than the Executive Branch Ethics Act. which I am under both the Executive Branch Ethics Act and the Rules of Professional Conduct in terms of my ethics. So the one thing I would say is that the only thing I can speak to them is I hope that all officials in Alaska understand their ethical obligations under the appropriate rules and follow them. And I certainly intend to, and I imagine this body does too.
And you know, just to give an analogy, if somebody was represent in their other job when they're not here as a legislator working for a company, and a bill came before us, they would raise that they had a conflict, and then we as legislators, someone would in the back say, "I object," and then they'd be forced to vote, which happens on a regular basis. But for you, and I think this is important to point out, you couldn't do that. You would be removed from the case, right? You represented Valdez. You can't hear cases from Valdez. You can't just say, "Hey, I have an objection. I served here. I have a conflict," and then go ahead and represent a case dealing with Valdez, because as a former client, under the Rules of Professional Conduct, you're prohibited from representing an issue that had to deal with them. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, usually is the answer. I mean, I don't want to get into too deep of a delve into the Rules of Professional Contract, but Rules of Professional Conduct, a substantially related matter, I believe, is the test.
And
yes,
Senator Wilkowski. I could, Madam Chair. Have you had an opportunity, are you familiar, because clearly you're not the first Attorney General that's dealt with the issue of conflicts. We've had some excellent, excellent Attorney Generals in recent years, John Burns, Michael Garrity, for instance. Came from private practice. I'm 100% sure they had conflicts. Do you have any sense of how they dealt with them and who some of their clients were?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, they handled it the same way I handled it, is that they delegated their authority. I believe in their cases, I read both of their delegations several months ago when I was doing this, and I honestly don't remember who their clients was, other than I recall John Burns represented one of the utilities out of Fairbanks. And they handled it in the same manner I did, with the exception of I delegated my authority to the section head of oil, gas, and mining, whereas they delegated their authority to Jim Cantor, who is the deputy. And the reason that happened differently was because when I came into office, Jim Cantor was out on long-term sick leave. So the next person in the chain on the cases was Martin Schultz.
There you go. Senator Wilkowski.
Just on the issue of Point Thompson, can you talk to us, because Point Thompson has been something that Alaskans have waited to be developed for 30 years. And how many plans of development did we go through? I want to thank you personally for being there and fighting for the people of Alaska to try to get Point Thompson developed, because we have waited for many, many years. How many plans of development were in place and changed over the years, do you know, before we finally got Point Thompson developed?
Senator Wilkowski, the chair, if my memory serves me right, 23 was the magical number. It was the 23rd plan of development that finally resulted in development.
I want to go back really quickly to Smart Justice, if I could. We had a presentation from the Pew Foundation, and they talked about how the deal fell apart under the last administration. I just want to ask you on the record if you've had conversations with them and whether or not it's your, they're working with corrections as well, but I'm hoping they've reached out to you, and if it's your intention to accept their offer to move forward with some data research. They want to do it for free, but we need it. And it sounds like they want to look at this 40% that are awaiting sentencing, and also the increase that we've had in nonviolent offenders that are being housed. So can you tell us a little bit about conversations you might have had with Pew and whether it's your intent to accept their offer?
Senator McGuire, I have not personally had conversations with Pew. Okay. I believe that their policy is that they require the head of both houses of the legislative body, the Chief Justice and the Governor's Office, to agree to accepting their services. So I did have a conversation twice now with the Governor's Office, once with the Governor himself, one with the Chief of Staff, encouraging him to accept that offer.
Great.
And based upon my conversations, I understand that he's leaning in that direction. And I will say that this is one of those where no one has come forward with a reason not to accept free advice.
Excellent. Great.
Senator Coghill.
It's not only free advice, it's actually digging into the statistics, and it's just, I think for the governor, it's just opening up the doors to books with some kind of an MOU on confidentiality to make sure that nobody's, and we can scrub the stats without names, so. First of all, I know that you've had several hearings, and the conflict of interest issue is certainly, because it's been reported in the press, one of the big deals. And like I said in the Resources Committee, you and the governor work together. You have worked with the chief of staff of the governor, and so all on oil and gas issues, and all with Port Authority issues, and then there was the question of how we dealt with an RCA ruling and the what was the name of the company? The Hillcorp. I think was it the Hillcorp company? Yeah. And can you just explain that? Because I think the public really deserves to hear a good explanation of how your part in that. Because I think at one point you asked the RCA for something, and you withheld the moving forward of the Hillcorp issue. And so, just explain that so that people get a better understanding. And certainly, I would like to have that understanding.
Senator Coghill, through the chair. So, addressing specifically the issue of the Attorney General's role in what I'll call the Fairbanks natural gas deal. And it's two different roles, two different hats. On the one hand, the Attorney General's Office, the Department of Law, provides legal advice to ADA and is representing them in that transaction. The other role is not as a client agency role, but as a people's attorney's role in the form of the RAPA, which is essentially the public policy arm for rate making for the state of Alaska, resides in a separate section of the Attorney General's office. And in a continuation with the former Attorney General's policy, RAPA has basically said that the sale of the liquefaction plant at Point McKenzie should not go forward to Hillcorp from a subsidiary of F&G, or an affiliate, not a subsidiary, an affiliate of F&G, until such time as there is a determination as to whether or not that plant should be subject to cost-based rate regulation. Typically, when you are a utility and you are integrated with a source of supply, or alternatively with some production system that leads to the ultimate distribution, the value chain downstream is often regulated on the same cost of service basis as is the actual distribution of the public utility. So the open question long before the F&G trucking, the F&G purchased by the ADA ever came up, was whether or not that liquefaction plant owned by an affiliate of F&G should be subject to the same rate regulation as the distribution arm of the utility in Fairbanks. Okay. So that is the open question. And what RAPA did is they asked that the approval of the sale of the plant not be approved until such time as the RCA makes the determination as to whether or not the plant itself should be subject to rate regulation. And that is something that I think the state filed its testimony on last week, filed its case. So I did continue the position of my predecessor to get a determination on that before a sale is approved.
So they just weren't tied together. I appreciate that, because the way we saw it in the press and the way we in Fairbanks looked at it, it looked like they were tied together. So I appreciate that.
No, they weren't. The RAPA situation has been ongoing for a year almost at this point.
So, Madam Chair?
Yeah.
A couple other questions. Some of my questions are going to be to inform you these are things we're thinking about as well, because I know that like on some of the federal issues, you're learning as fast as many of we are. In fact, some of the federal issues are coming at us so fast we don't know how to deal with them. So I appreciate some of the learning curve. Some of the conflicts that we deal with in Alaska are our game management, and the Attorney General has a whole another set of attorneys that deals with working with the game board, the fish board, and they do some really thorny issues. But they quite often rise to the level of the courts and the Supreme Court. And there was one case that I was particularly watching, because it deals with who gets to participate in hunting, basically. And it was the, and I'm bringing this up for attention, it was the Maury case that the state has to deal with, and that deals with all Alaskans being eligible to participate in a Tier 1 harvest. And this is an unsettled question in Alaska. This is not on you. I'm just bringing it up that it's something I'm watching. Have you had a chance to look at it? Is that something new? I could certainly work through your office, but it's something that, it comes down to how do we equitably allow Alaskans to hunt in a Tier 1 hunt.
Senator Coghill, through the chair on that one, I'm afraid I'm going to have to use my lifeline. I'm not familiar with the fact pattern of the case.
It's just something that's coming your way, that's all. And quite often the state has taken different positions down through the years. And on this particular issue, I would be interested to have another and further conversation with you. I'm certainly not the most expert on it myself, but we get these coming at us as well, how to protect Alaskans, whether it's allocation of fish or how to hunt, and which brings up another issue. I'm sorry, I brought it up in Resources Committee.
Can you go back to Hillcrop really quickly, just because you're right, in the news, was it described that there was already a contract between Hillcrop and FNG in place? Is that the issue, is that there's an allegation that there's torturous interference of a contract or something?
Senator McGuire,
did they already have a contract in place,
no.
And that's their concern?
No. Okay. Let me break it down on a timeline that I think makes sense.
Okay.
So, first item, call it roughly a year ago, 8 months ago, there was an attempt to sever the affiliate relationship between the liquefaction plant and the distribution system by
owned
FNG.
By both FNG.
Owned by FNG.
Okay.
And that's where the challenge by the state occurred. Just before I came into office, there was a deal entered into between Titan, the affiliate of FNG, that now has, is now the umbrella corporation for the liquefaction plant, to sell that plant to an independent company, Hillcorp.
Okay.
And so one of the first official actions that I took into office was to say, oh, no, wait, let's not allow that sale until we have guidance from the RCA about whether the plant should be rate regulated or whether it should not be rate regulated.
Okay.
A month or two after that is when I learned that ADA was looking at the acquisition of FNG on the part of the state.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, just to even complicate it worse, and maybe you can comment on this, the firm that you sold, I think Brenna people picked up, and they just happened to represent North Star Borough,
right,
which is looking at the purchase of FNG. To some degree, because of their utility. I mean, that was part of the discussion. And maybe if I got the facts wrong, but you might explain that part too, because that kind of was part of the news cycle that we had to deal with.
So, I think you've described it accurately. I will say that the firm that did ultimately purchase my firm, that they do represent the Interior Gas Utility.
Yeah.
I had no professional interaction with that firm in their representation of IGU whatsoever. In fact, the opposite is true, because I had represented the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority that looked at an independent purchase of FNG 5 years before or 4 years before. Mr. Brenner was very careful to make sure that even when I went over there, the room that he had for IGU was locked and I didn't get to see in the door. So
it's just you can't live in Alaska and work in some of these issues without rubbing shoulders on all these. And I wanted to have that brought up, because that was actually one of the questions that came running my way. I'm thinking I didn't make all those connections, and some people were making connections, and I appreciate you answering that, because up in the interior we want natural gas, and I don't want to stumble over it so much. But I know that the firm you'd sold had been a part of it, and then you had represented the Port Authority on a very similar topic. So, thank you.
Did you already ask about the Tununek case?
Not yet.
Okay. Were you going to
go ahead? No, go ahead.
So, are you following the Native Village of Tununek
and the request that the state join that particular case regarding Indian Child Welfare Act, and do you have any comments about
Sir,
it? May you make
Senator,
any comments about it?
It's been a hard one not to follow the last
okay.
couple of weeks.
I would figure
I'll put it that
I
way, based
on
the amount of email I've received.
Okay.
So the state, of course, won that case, and the issue at bar is whether or not to apply the ICWA adoption preference to place Native children in with, you know, first with the family, then with the tribe, then with another Native American tribe, whether or not, in order for the adoption preference to operate, whether or not the Native person seeking to have the preference applied, whether or not they need to file for adoption first. So the case at bar at the state Supreme Court level said that, yes, they did, based upon largely a reading of a U.S. Supreme Court case that the state contended said the same thing. It is on the side of the grandmother that said that she wants to adopt, but the ultimately was ruled that the placement preference didn't apply because she didn't file to adopt soon enough. Filed for rehearing. The state intends to join and support its prior position, but there has certainly been a lot of pushback among some that the state should change its position and basically take the other side of a case that it had won several months ago. So the state is continuing to do its position, but we did ask for a 30-day extension to reach out to the stakeholders and try to listen to what people have to say.
Okay. Difficult.
Different topic?
Yes. Senator Coco.
As the attorney for the state, one of the things that happens here, and this is where Senator Wilkowski and I really work together well, I think, and that is on cybersecurity, personal privacy, scams that are coming our way. They're coming at a breakneck speed, and it looks like the issues of protecting people are a big deal. I'm just putting it on the list of things to think about. Have you had any experience in how to protect people from some of those scams? Things that an attorney general can do. We've tried everywhere we can to write it into law, but they change almost as fast as we write them. So,
Senator Kiger, through the chair, I mean, no direct experience. I will say that when I was at the National Association of Attorneys General Conference, that this was a major point of discussion, and every attorney general's office in the whole country is struggling with how to keep up with these things. They're incredibly complex. So I'm aware of the issue, and we certainly have folks within the consumer protection group, within the Department of Law, that have worked it and are working it and continue to working it on behalf of Alaskans. But that's where we are. We're trying to keep up, but I can tell you this is one that everybody's struggling with across the country.
As you learn things that that we could do better, I think we in the legislature, especially in this committee, probably would be interested in things that maybe are loopholes, places where we have blind spots. I think we're interested because, you know, it takes a long time to put something in hard law, and sometimes we through compromise, can't always get it just exactly right. You have probably better eyes than we do. We get to hear from constituents, and that's the only time we're made aware. Quite often, you see them coming through a variety of different methods, everything from, consumer complaints to law cases. So I'd just say as a working relationship between the Department of Law and the legislature, that is one key area we need to communicate well in. So just be aware.
I'll tag it, flag another subject for you. Sex trafficking and sex assault and domestic violence. The First Lady is a huge fan of yours, as you probably know. I was meeting with her a couple of weeks ago, and she wanted to sing your praises. But this is an issue that she wants to take up. And so we were talking about ways to think about this a little bit differently than it's been thought about in the past. And when you're at these national conferences, to the degree that you start thinking about state lines and how we can form alliances, I think that's been one of the challenges in the area of sex trafficking is, you know, you crack down in one area and people move the operation across state lines. But of course, it's no secret to you that our state has been, you know, the leader. We're at the top in these areas. When Dan Sullivan was our Attorney General, I had a meeting with him in my office, and he said, what are the subjects you want to talk about? And I said, I have a lot of them, but I'm going to take my entire time to just talk about sex assault and domestic violence, because in my time in the legislature, and I guess then it would have been 13 years, I said I've either chaired or been on judiciary in the House and the Senate every year, and the statistics have not gone down, and we still lead. In every category, every age, we still lead the nation in sexual and physical assault against our children and the women in our state. So I just flagged that issue for you because there's only 735,000 of us, and I just feel like as a polis, we can do it. We can take it on. And I use the example of drunk driving, that when we were growing up, mm-hmm. As kids, there was just a generalized acceptance of it. Right. It just wasn't a big deal culturally. And Mothers Against Drunk Driving formed, and we started to change the way we viewed it. Mm-hmm. And it became socially unacceptable, and the laws changed here. We went to 0.08, and then we sort of ratcheted down to zero tolerance. Started putting people in jail. And I don't know what the answers are. We've made stronger penalties here at the legislative level. We've started the Choose Respect campaign. But I ask you, as a father, as a husband, to please add this to your portfolio. Dan Sullivan started it. We've had attorney generals before you that have. But when you're out there thinking about that general way that we can just send the message that our state is the last place you want to come if you're going to victimize human beings, go somewhere else. I just flag that for you because it's a big issue to our committee.
Thank you, Senator. It is. Obviously, domestic violence in Alaska is at hand, and we all need to work together to do what we can.
You know, and especially when you think of the children, that it's a soul death, and the cycle of it that starts when you're victimized at such a young age. When you think the ages, as a CASA, you learn 0 to 3 is where you learn 75% of everything you're going to learn in your life. And if that's part of what you're learning, it's no secret then that you go on, I mean, it's no surprise that you go on to possibly victimize others, you go on to have learning disabilities, you go on to have substance abuse problems, all the other things that happen. So, but I invite you to think about working with the First Lady on it, too. It'd be neat to see the two of you as a team.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. And, yeah, absolutely, Senator McGuire has hit on it. She's been a champion for this, for that over the years, and this committee's really focused on the issue of sexual abuse, child abuse, domestic violence for years. I hope that is a priority for you. I do just want to give you an opportunity, because I don't know when we're going to get back hearing from you on resources, and this question did come up yesterday. There were some questions about your representation of Valdez in the TAPS case and Trans-Alaska Pipeline case, which you prevailed. And representing Valdez, but you were questioned about this, about being in a position opposite of the state, and I found that to be kind of puzzling, because, and I never understood why the state took the position they took, because had the state prevailed, local communities would have lost tens of millions of dollars. The oil industry would have made tens of millions of dollars. The local communities, the property taxpayers, would have lost tens of millions of dollars in having to pay additional property taxes. Am I accurate in that assessment?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, big case, a lot of complex issues. I think it's fair to say that the state's position was actually a lot closer to the municipality's position than it was to the TAPS owners. Just boiling it down to numbers, for instance, the municipalities, for a good portion of the case, asserted the TAPS was worth about $13 billion, the state maybe in the 7-8 range, the TAPS owners in the 1 range. So just on a numbers basis, maybe you could call it half. So, but on a methodological position, they were much more aligned with the municipalities, with some exceptions.
Senator Wilkowski.
But the difference between 7 or 8 and $13 billion in terms of how much revenue the local communities, and indeed the state would get, is about how much money?
It's $20 million per billion for total government collections, because it's 20 mils, so the difference in $5 billion is $100 million.
Wow. Gotcha.
Yes, Senator Cargill.
I know we're running real close on time, so first of all, thank you for taking the job. I mean, I think our responsibility is to ask questions that people generally in public are asking, so thank you for having good answers. I think you've done very well. One of the things I would encourage you to do, Constitution being our guide, the next thing we have as one of our best defenses is ANILCA. And it's a complex, compromised document. There's no doubt about that. But it's and when it first came in, I was not a big fan of it because I thought we gave up way, way too much. But it is what it is. But it's going to be an important part of your lexicon from here on. And so your ANILCA team is going to be very important. And I know in some of the cuts in DNR, that has been part of the question. And I know we have to slim down. So that means somebody has to pass on knowledge. You have to be a part of that, and the lawyers have to be a part of it. So it's something that we in the legislature have kind of in our rearview mirror. We don't have it in our front one. It should be in everybody's front view, and it should be one of the templates that we look at how we protect Alaskans in a very unique circumstance in the federal arena. So I hope that as you're learning, that's part of the lexicon that will be your digesting, that you'll be digesting.
Senator Cargill, through the chair, absolutely. In fact, coincidentally, I just asked my staff to put together the big binder on the history of ANILCA for me, and I'm going to need to dive into it here in the next month or two.
Yeah.
In terms of answering the tough questions, I will say that one thing that I've come to realize over the last few days is I like being a lawyer better than the witness.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. And, you know, you're working with the House and the Senate in your departments. One of the things I always say, you know, to people, don't be afraid to be candid about where you can't afford a cut. Mm-hmm. You know, part of what we're going through here in the House and the Senate, it's growing pains. I mean, we've been relying on one source, a hydrocarbon source, and one single infrastructure project now for 37 years in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline for our budget. And that's going to change, and we're going to have to reconfigure and think about that. And there'll be cuts that go along the way as a part of that. But there are some places where cutting is not going to help the state. And when you think about ANILCA, when you think about the EPA and ESA challenges and things like that, that doesn't help us get to where we need to go. So I encourage you to be a zealous advocate for your departments and the places where you certainly can't afford, where you've, as you said, been building. And certainly where you're making cuts from privatization and have built a strong department, don't go backward. I'm sure you've already thought through that, but I think that's important and healthy to think about.
Thank you, Senator McGuire, and I think already I've tried to exercise in that way by encouraging the Senate to put back in the funding for at least part of the PAD unit.
Yeah, that's important. Okay, well, thank you very much. Godspeed in your work. Thank you for taking the call to public service. It's a pay cut, and it's a huge sacrifice. Thank you to your family, to your wife, and to your young son, also because your family serves too. So we thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, we're adjourned.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Oh, my apologies.
Motion,
back on the record.
Are we doing a motion to forward?
Oh, my apologies. We do need a motion. Wait, we just got ahead of ourselves. Okay, I move and ask unanimous consent that we forward the name of Craig Richards along as Attorney General for the State of Alaska. This nomination does not reflect any members' individual vote on the floor. This is in accordance with AS 3905080. And with that, we are adjourned, and members, please sign the form.